Begin. This morning we only have one bill, and hopefully it won't take all morning, but we have Senate File 671. Senator Latz moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. You should have before you, the spreadsheet dated April 8th at 4:06 p.m., and that is the spreadsheet reflected in the division report. So I will walk you through that, and then I will just tell you in terms of the bill itself, there's no real policy in the bill. The language that's in there is mostly just implementation riders or to the budget itself. I'll point out the one or two places where that's not the case for you. So let's just work through the spreadsheet. The first item on the spreadsheet is Supreme Court. And I will tell you as a predicate for all the employee salary and health insurance increase lines in here, it's adopting the same assumptions that all of the agencies and the governor have adopted in terms of percentage increases in health care insurance cost increases. So we're just utilizing the same numbers that were there throughout the other finance divisions. Separate from that, the judge's salary increase that's listed on line 6, that adopts the Compensation Council report, a recommendation in its entirety in terms of the salary increase itself, as well as state assistance to prevent their increased pension contribution that's part of the overall pension system repair. Line 7, we are carrying in this bill the state's share of the judge's pension increase. I'm told that that's the way we're doing it right now in terms of the funding for the overall pension bill. And maybe that'll change down the line somewhere, but for now anyway, that's being carried in this division bill as well. Line 8, Senate File 235, that is the gun bill or the portion of the gun package, I should say the gun violence reduction package, that had fiscal impact. For your information, Senate File 458, which had the pure policy questions without fiscal impact, including the expansion of the background checks, is not in this budget. It had no fiscal impact. That still remains in the Senate Rules Committee now. So what we have before us in this budget is the funding for Senate File 235, which itself is also traveling separately and is before the Finance Committee as a separate bill, not to be considered today. The funding, the pieces of it, however, that require funding, basically it's most of it is backfilling the databases for the background checks that are already conducted under current law, the databases relating to criminal convictions and relating to mental health commitments. The Supreme Court Integration Project is the cost to the courts of doing some of that data gathering, collecting, putting it in the proper electronic format, transmitting it to the BCA.
Mr. Chair, I would like to interrupt you briefly just to say that at the time we adopted the committee report, we did have a quorum at that time. So please continue.
As a foreshadowing of an amendment that we will have when I'm done, there's another cost relating to Senate File 235, the gun bill, and that cost is related to gathering and putting in proper format the civil commitment or mental health commitment data going back from 1994 to 2008. We already have the data in proper format, or at least gathered as well as we can from 2008 forward. This was also a part of the Senate File 235. There's a lot of data that was residing with DHS and which a lot of us thought was being sent to the National Instant Criminal Background Check System, but because NICS would not accept it from an agency that did not create the data wasn't going anywhere. And so it has to come from the courts, and in order to get that in the proper format to do it, it's a pretty big project, a lot of records, many of which are not yet in electronic format at all, and are maintained off-site. So there's going to be an $800,000 line to accomplish that, which will be part of a subsequent amendment, and we've got the funding mechanism worked out for that that I will explain at that time.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Latz, on that point, when we had this in committee, maybe my recall is faulty this morning, but I thought that we were only reaching back to 96 on that data. And
Senator Limmer, Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, the spreadsheet that was before the committee at the time had an error in the year, and we corrected that on the record. No? I'll let Mr. Turner explain that then. There was talk about splitting up because of the large cost,
right,
only going back to year 2000, and whether we could go back to 1994. And what we ultimately decided to do was to carry the find the funding in a different place from the original Judiciary Committee budget, go all the way back to 1994, which was the year that was originally in Senator Ortman's bill. And there, at one time, 1996 was typed into a spreadsheet, and that was a typo.
Senator
Maybe
Limmer,
that's where you recall the year coming from.
94. Senator Limmer, any backup, any follow-up?
Oh, I just needed a clarification. Thank you, Senator Latz.
Senator Newman.
Senator Latz, in terms of line 8,
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Newman, that's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions before Senator Latz continues? Seeing none.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Civil Legal Services is the next category. There is an increase in the funding for Civil Legal Services over what the governor recommends for purposes of caseload reduction. They are currently only able to serve about one-third of the potential persons that come in and ask for civil legal services from them, a very inadequate amount, and we've been able to find within the budget some money to reverse the trend of cuts in that agency, and so they can provide the services that people need. It doesn't go anywhere near to funding 100% of the necessary services, but we can we increase the funding there to help. Court of Appeals and district court lines there are the same as with regard to the Supreme Court in terms of the employee salaries, judges' salaries, and state share of the pension increase. Guardian ad litem board on the next page. We adopt the governor's recommendations in its entirety. The tax court is an interesting situation. In the course of the last biennium, there were two resignations from the tax court. So they were shorthanded. In addition, there are some issues relating to the chief judge of the tax court, part of it arising out of caseload issues and their inability to keep up with a growing and very demanding caseload in complex cases. So there are now two new tax court judges that have taken over the administrative responsibility for the court. When they made their presentation to the governor, they decided that for now anyway, they can try to proceed with the total of three judge units on the tax court. If they were to ask for an increase, and frankly, they could probably use one, they're mandated by law to have an odd number of judges. They'd have to go up to five. There'd be a big fiscal impact there. They think there are better ways to try to address their case management system. So they're seeking two new law clerks, access to better continuing legal education, Westlaw access, if you can believe it. They didn't have a monthly Westlaw access fee. For those of you familiar, that's the standard legal research tool. We'd want our judges to be able to access it. And the one thing that was not in the governor's budget, because the tax court judges didn't realize this until after that was proposed, their computer system that manages their cases is from the year 2000. The vendor doesn't even support it anymore. And the new desktops that have been brought in for the support staff won't even communicate with the current case management system. So they need to upgrade that. They can use savings on the salary line from their vacancies to purchase the program, but they'll need operation and maintenance costs ongoing, and that's the $25,000 per year that's included in there. The Uniform Laws Commission for a number of years has been operating.
Mr. Chair, hold on. I think we have a question. Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, the tax court, what are the cases they're handling again? Is it just property tax issues, or I don't recall, if you could just refresh.
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrom, it is appeals on property tax valuations. And income tax appeals, as well as I understand it. The real complex ones get into a lot of the commercial property valuations. They're disputing what the county assessor or the city assessor has valued a property at, and you can get into, frankly, some very lengthy and complicated market evaluation as well.
So, Mr.
Senator
Chair,
Westrom.
Senator Latz, income tax, that would be also a person or a company took a deduction they thought was legitimate, and an auditor said not, and then they took that through the court process. Does it go right to this panel, or does it go through the district court and then appeal to this court? Or am I right on my premise of the income tax or the revenue tax side of things?
Senator Letts.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrom, I don't know the details of that answer, and we'll see if we can find a little more information for you on that. I do recall from their presentation that over the last, I don't know, 7-8 years, their caseload has gone up by 100 or 200%, something like that. I mean, they're handling, with the same amount of judges, 5,000 or so cases a year now that they used to handle 1,000 cases. So their workload is.
Senator Westrom, a follow-up, or are you okay?
No, if staff could get me that.
I think Senator Newman might have some information on that.
Senator Newman.
Mr. Chairman.
And from there,
it's an
appeal, I believe.
Senator Letts.
We found the information provided by the tax court at their presentation to the committee. 98% of the court's caseload is reviewing property tax assessments from all 87 counties, and these range from individual homes to large industrial and commercial facilities. Issues include challenges to assessed values, property classification for tax purposes, exemptions from taxation, and real versus personal property distinctions. Also, what they do is review orders issued by the Commissioner of Revenue, and that's the other 2% of their caseload, and those orders relate to Minnesota individual and corporate income tax computation, residency challenges, determination of unitary businesses. They also address issues relating to state sales and use taxes coming out of the Commissioner of Revenue's orders. So important to note, their decisions tend to have broad precedential effect. Their caseload the last year they gave us data on 2012, they had 4,705 property tax appeals, 125 commissioner appeals, total caseload of 4,830 cases in the year 2012 for three judges to handle.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Westrom.
Senator Latz, appreciate that information. I'm just sitting here thinking, and just as food for thought, I wonder if they use ADR or if there's a way to relieve some of this pressure with more highly suggested mediation or alternative dispute resolution processes. I don't know if they use them now at all or not, but might be something that would help relieve some of that pressure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Westrom, I know that the two judges that have are grappling with how to manage this caseload are fairly new, and I got the distinct impression they were looking at every opportunity within the operations there to try to become more efficient and to handle that large caseload.
Committee, any more questions on this point? If not, Senator Latz, please proceed forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. The Uniform Laws Commission is a national organization of highly skilled lawyers that look at the laws across the country in jurisdictions and then make recommendations for standardizing laws across the states so that businesses and individuals can have a more common set of rules on certain things. The Uniform Commercial Code is the most well-known of all of those, but they have them in all sorts of different areas. Minnesota has participation in that, and in fact, in the next year, a Minnesotan will be the chair of the National Uniform Laws Commission. We have been unable in past budget years to keep up with the dues, so this budget includes catching up on all the back dues that are owed to the National Uniform Laws Commission, and it fully funds the budget for our uniform law commissioners in Minnesota to participate in the national work. We are overrepresented in terms of our state's population on this distinguished body, and we should frankly consider it an honor that we have such strong representation in this group. The Board on Judicial Standards, we fund their budget request. In addition, as is typically done, they have some exceptional hearing costs that they farm out investigation to private attorneys or investigators. This year, the request for that, I think they had like five extraordinary disciplinary proceedings they had to conduct, cost $300,000 in investigation, and so we are paying for that. It's a one-time appropriation. That's the way that they've operated because it's very hard for them to predict in any given year what their investigative costs are going to be because they don't know what complaints will come in. The Board of Public Defense, this is an area that, for a long time was underfunded and, in fact, had been cut. In the last budget, we were able to provide with them with some increase. It is well understood throughout the legal system that a well-funded and a fully staffed public defense system is critical to the efficient and effective operation of the court systems. The stories that we frequently hear are judges and county attorneys and city attorneys and court personnel and everyone else waiting around a courtroom while the public defender, who's got far too many cases on his or her shoulders, is supposed to be in four different courtrooms at the same time. They've had issues with regard to training new employees in and having them leave very quickly under the crushing caseload for greener pastures. So there's some long overdue salary increases that are in here above and beyond the standard increase that are given to throughout the other agencies. There's also some additional funding in here for new hires to reduce the caseload and to keep the operations of the courts moving more smoothly. We have learned in the process of putting the budget together that the costs of transcripts on appeal have only been partly funded in recent years, that they run out of cash in that account about halfway through the year, and they are unable to pay court reporters for the transcripts. So we have increased their transcript base to reflect that, and they've had a longstanding information technology request as well. We have separately itemized that funding in this budget to send the clear message that we want this money used for that purpose and not salted into other operations expenses for the public defense. They desperately need to update their computer programs. The county attorneys keep updating theirs, and the evidence that's supplied to the public defenders is in electronic format that is very, very difficult in many cases for the public defenders to even to play on their computers. So they need an information technology increase, and we've separated that out. Peace Officer and Board, it's the the governor's recommendation with one addition. We have been unable to give them decent funding for training in past years, and so we have added a little bit of money in the scheme of things, but hopefully a helpful amount to facilitate training for police officers in Minnesota. Page 3, the Private Detective Board is the governor's request. A Human Rights Department is a governor's request that includes two new enforcement officers, not only to reflect the increased number of complaints the offices receives, but also they have obligation for compliance review. They review compliance with the human rights laws for state contracts. There are two major construction projects now underway that are going to require a lot of Human Rights Department attention. That is the St. Croix River Bridge and the People's or Vikings Stadium project. Very large multi-million dollar contracts that even recently it turns out there have been some compliance issues, so the department needs to have the resources to conduct those compliance checks. The Corrections Department is the largest single item in the budget. And we give the governor's request in terms of...
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Senator Westrom.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Senator Latz, back to that Human Rights Department. You were mentioning there's two large projects, so we need to add more people. Can you tell me, are we just anticipating there's going to be problems? Do we go looking for problems, or is it... that there's a statistic that with large projects they know there's going to be 10 calls that come in and therefore they need to do it? Or do they actually go out and proactively try to probe for problems?
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrom, probably most of what you described. The department is charged by law with reviewing state contracts for compliance with the human rights statutes. They act in an educational manner by providing seminars and direct assistance to businesses to comply with the state contract requirements relating to human rights. So they answer a lot of questions. They have a lot of individual interaction with businesses to try to prevent any problems from arising, educating the businesses so they understand how to comply with state law. They also review all the contracts and the compliance with those contracts as well. Just that alone, given the large projects that I described, the St. Croix River Bridge and the stadium, there are going to be a lot of contracts, a lot of complexity to them, a lot of subcontractors to monitor compliance with hiring requirements and so on. So just the review of the contracts and assisting businesses and complying with the law with regard to that is going to take substantial resources. When it appears that compliance is not occurring, then the department also will make efforts to bring the businesses into compliance, and where that's not possible, they don't think it's going to happen, they can either advise that the contract be relet, or they can take enforcement action if that's appropriate. But their primary effort in connection with this here is to try to prevent problems from developing and ensure that compliance is made.
Senator Westrom, any follow-up?
No.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The in the Corrections Department, line 103, there are 100 chemical dependency treatment beds that are funded in this budget. About 90% of the inmates in the correctional facilities are chemically dependent. If they come in that way, they leave that way unless they receive treatment. If they leave chemically dependent, we know most of the crime in Minnesota is associated in one way or another with chemical dependency, and public safety is jeopardized if we don't make efforts to treat them while they're in custody. They don't have enough CD treatment beds in custody. And we've known that for a long time, but we haven't had the ability to fund an increase in the number of beds. We have found the ability in this budget to do so. This will do a couple of things. One, it'll increase public safety. Number two, it'll improve the management of the inmates in the correctional facilities. Number three, it will save people money down the road when there is less crime and when the transition into the community is more successful for a variety of reasons. If they've got chemical dependency problems when they leave, it's going to be harder to get and keep a job, harder to find housing, and it's tough enough with a conviction record to be able to do that, let alone adding those issues. Right now, their priority is on high-risk offenders, meaning those who are at highest risk for chemical dependency problems. There's also a program that's in a bill carried by Senator Hayden that expired but is being reintroduced to for early release for low-level offenders, lower-risk offenders, who are not the priority for the existing shortage of treatment beds.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Latz, in your committee when this issue was presented, was there any information given to you to reflect that the rate of success for chemical treatment?
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Newman, I don't recall the specifics, but my recollection generally is that there is a higher, there's a reduced rate of recidivism from people that have control of their chemical dependency issues than if they don't. I think the number is something like 70% or 80% of all crimes in Minnesota are associated one way or another with chemical dependency, you know, whether it's the felony drug offenses, the connection's obvious there. Whether it's assaults, burglaries, often it's to get property or money to be able to pay for a drug habit, or whether they're enterprises, even more related to that.
Senator Newman.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Latz, I agree with you that chemical dependency greatly increases the number of crimes committed in the state. So my question is that if you provide the chemical successful so that we know that the money that we are spending for the additional 100 deaths is money well spent.
Senator Latz.
I've got some information here, courtesy of the Department of Corrections. Mr. Chairman, Senator Newman, research shows that prison-based treatment is effective. A recent evaluation found that successful participation in the department's CD programs effectively reduced recidivism by 23%. That was based on an evaluation, an outcome evaluation, March 2010. A study of California's substance abuse treatment programs found that every dollar spent on drug and alcohol treatment saves the public $7 through reduced crime. When averted health care costs were included, the savings increased to $12 for each dollar invested in treatment. So there appears to be evidence-based for concluding that treatment will be effective in reducing recidivism. I can tell you right now the department's calculation, the number of offenders assessed as needing treatment yearly is 2,900. The offenders entering the DOC's long-term treatment program is 1,200. 72% of those offenders complete the program, average time 8 months. The number of beds that they have is 804. So they are way underbedded in terms of the need.
Any other questions on this point? If none, Senator Latz.
Thank you. The department is maintaining their base budget. They've had a 4% vacancy rate agency-wide in terms of their staff. They'd prefer to have 2%, but they would rather keep the staff that they have and utilize their money most efficiently. So they're managing and propose to continue to manage with a 4% vacancy rate. They concentrate those vacancies in the management level, not in the line officers. They're having direct interaction with the inmates for obvious safety reasons. The line 106 is the funding for the bed impact is Senator Cohen's bill that reinstates a mandatory 3-year prison sentence for repeat sex offenders. This was a statutory change that we believe was inadvertent about 5 years ago, and it wasn't caught until it was until more recently, and so this reinstates that. There's a bet impact. Also, in Senate File 235, the gun bill, there's one provision that also has a bet impact. It's the expansion of the definition of crimes of violence, which is used to determine those ineligible to possess firearms. The crime of violence definition would be expanded to include felony strangulation, felony domestic assault, and felony fifth-degree assault. There will be more persons determined to be ineligible to possess firearms who are found with firearms as a result of this change. Some of them will go to prison, and it has a bad impact, so we fund that. In the community services section of the Department of Corrections, the major feature here are lines 116 and 117, funding the county probation officers and the Community Corrections Act probation officers. The state correctional system is basically three components within the probation piece of it. Minnesota has a low incarceration, high probation in the community model. It's why we have one of the most, one of the least expensive correctional systems in the country. It's a very efficient system, and it works very well because we also have a low recidivism rate in comparison to other places in the country. But it, what it means is we need to have adequate funding for the probation officers in the field to monitor the persons who are serving their sentences in the community. The Department of Corrections was able to fund the corrections or the POs that are employed by DOC, but that's only a portion of the probation officers in the state. The rest of the system is in lines 116 and 117. They were not funded in DOC's base budget, and they were not funded anywhere else. If we do nothing, they will in effect receive in real terms, a cut in funding because their costs increase like everyone else's increase. They have been a place where budgets in the past have gone to realize savings in the state spending, which means that the statutory share of or split between county and state of 50%, 50% has changed over the years to 70% picked up by the counties, 30% by the state. The funding that we will propose here will not, I don't think, end up changing that percentage, but it will not exacerbate it either. We will be able to maintain, hopefully, current levels of service without forcing the counties to pick up additional costs or to cut the probation officers in the CCA and CPO counties. This area will also be the subject of an amendment that we'll offer at the end, which is going to increase this line item substantially, and I will explain that in a few minutes. Sentencing Guidelines Commission. The electronic sentencing worksheet is a one-time expense to upgrade their system so that probation officers, when they're doing pre-sentence investigations and recommendations for sentencing to the judges for those who are convicted of felonies, will have accurate information and should not only speed up the process, the estimation is it'll shave 15 or 20 minutes off of their per case when they do this, and when you handle as many cases in the system as that, that kind of savings in time is substantial. It will also help reduce sentencing errors, there are a lot of eyes that look at this in the process, but sometimes errors go through. There was recently a case where a person spent it was determined in the Court of Appeals level that a person spent 9 months longer than they should have been serving in prison because of a sentencing error at the district court. And so this is an important ability to make sure that catch as many of those errors as possible before they get reflected in the actual sentence.
I'll do the totals and put it back.
Okay. And that brings us to the totals on the back page, and I'm going to ask Mr. Turner, our fiscal analyst, to review those for the committee.
Thank you, Senator Lesch. Mr. Turner, identify yourself for the record, and then let's go forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Chris Turner, Senate Fiscal Analyst for the Judiciary Committee. I'd just like to point out that the governor's target in this area was $1,755,027,000. It's on line 149. As you can see, our general fund spending on 139 came to $1,763,227. That's $8.2 million over the governor. We got that. We picked up that $8.2 million in part with a $5 million increase in straight general fund, is a straight general fund target. And then the rest of it is picked up on line 144, the transfer in from the MinCorps Revolving Fund. That's the Minnesota Correctional Industries Revolving Fund. We transfer in $1,700 a year for $3,400, or $3,400,000. And then it's offset by the increase to the post board of $200 for a total of $3,200,000. That's where the $8.2 million comes from. And our final target was $1,760,027,000.
Is that it?
Members, that's the description of the budget, and with the chairman's permission, I'd like to proceed to the amendments that I will propose.
If there are no questions on the budget, let's proceed to the amendments.
Okay. I think you guys have the copies. It's the A9 amendment that I'd like to go with first, please.
The committee should be receiving the A9 amendment.
If you want to have this one handed out as well, and do them both home, related.
Maybe if we could also have the A10 amendment handed out, they are related to the same issue.
Senator Latz, would you like to describe or have one of the testifiers describe the A9 amendment?
I'll let you go ahead, Chris.
Mr. Turner.
Mr. Chairman, members, under current law, the state and the counties are liable for all medical costs incurred when one of their inmates is hospitalized on an inpatient basis outside the confines of the prison or jail. And recent changes in federal law have made it possible to enroll MA-eligible inmates in Medicaid. This produces sizable savings for the state. Sizable savings for the state and the counties. Unfortunately, it produces a cost to DHS because they are responsible for paying the state's share in Medicaid. So what we have is we have savings coming into the state and the counties, and which are roughly twice the size of the cost of DHS. It makes it complicated because it's an interagency transfer, but we are going to go ahead with it, and I will explain to you what the effects on the Department of Corrections are. This provision is being carried in Senator Lori's Health and Human Services budget bill, and I will now go over the amendment. If you've all got it.
And I just want to make sure that everyone on the committee have received the A9 amendment. Seeing that they have, Mr. Turner, you're going to walk us through that amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. And members, there are two other things that are being passed out. One is a worksheet titled The Fiscal Impact of Senate File 777. I'll go through that in a minute. And then a second spreadsheet, which reflects the effects of the amendment. First of all, on A9, just to get to the technical details, lines 1.3 to 1.6 amend the totals for the bill because there were some transfers between the fiscal years. 1.7 and 1.8 reflect an $800,000 appropriation to the Supreme Court for the 1994 to 2008 mental illness record reach back that Senator Latt spoke about earlier. 1.9 to 1.10 is changing the totals on the entire Department of Corrections heading in the bill. 1.13 to 1.7 appropriates money to the DOC for medical release planners necessary when we go ahead with this Medicaid provision. 1.18 to 1.20 is changing the totals in the community services heading. 1.21 to 1.22 is the new adjusted Community Corrections Act appropriation. 1.23 to 1.25 is the new adjusted county probation officer reimbursement appropriation. And then 1.26 to 1.28 is not related to the Medicaid provision. It amends the judge's salary pension rider. We were told that it was only necessary to impose the 1% the first year, the 1% of the judge's share the first year, and then it would carry through in the tails. That is the amendment, but I think I'd like to refer to the worksheet, and that'll give you some idea, a better idea, of what we're trying to do.
So I just want to make sure that all the committee members have in receipt of the new tracking sheet. Anyone need that? Okay, looks like we have it. Okay. Proceed, Mr. Turner.
Okay. On the worksheet titled Fiscal Impact of Senate File 777 Hayden and Senate File 976 Hayden as well, this amendment included the big Medicaid bill and then the bill about the early release of nonviolent drug offenders in DOC, which Senator Latz also mentioned earlier. It is traveling on its own. It's in front of the Finance Committee. It's in the Finance Quee right now. But we are carrying the savings on that. So we have small savings of $120,000 for Senator Hayden's 976, but we have savings of total of $4,800,000 in the pension or the Medicaid bill. If you'll see on the first line, Senate File 77, Health Services Savings Medicaid, those are the savings $1,635,014. It doesn't go into effect until January 1st of 2014, so it's essentially half a year. And $5,228,015 for a total of $6,863,000. This savings comes in DOC institutions, the division of institutions. Within the division, they need two medical release planners to implement the provisions of the bill. And then there's the two big costs, the shift from DOC to DHS. First, the DOC state share, that's for state inmates who are hospitalized and are Medicaid eligible, and then the DOC county share, county inmates and county jails who are eligible, who are hospitalized outside the confines of the jail. And that's $1,061,000 for the state. For the 14 to 15, it's $1,404,000 for the state, $1,266,000 for the county. That only uses up a portion of the $6.8 million. The rest is transferred out of the institutions division. We transfer $3,189,000 to community services within DOC, and they are the people who are in charge of probationary supervision. And then we transfer $800 to the Supreme Court for the mentally ill records reach back for the gun bill. Total transfers, $3,989,000. We already have $800,000 in the bill for Community Corrections Act and County Probation Officer appropriations. And then we have the Senate File 976 savings of $120,000. That's the other Senator Hayden bill for a total of $4,909,000. And then you go down and you'll see how we appropriate that. $800,000 for the reach back. institutions, $80,000 for the institutions, because before we were paying for Senator Cohen, Senator Cohen's bill and the gun bill, the small $80,000 that they cost in this biennium, out of the institutions. So we reimburse the institutions there. Then we take the remainder and we allocate it to the CCA and CPO on an 88% to CCA and 12% to CPO. That comes to $3,545,000 for CCA and $484,000 for CPO. And if you'll see, the total appropriation is $4.9 million, and that matches the total transfer. That's the financial implications. You can track these in the bill, page 3 of the new, or on the spreadsheet, page 3 of this, the major lines, lines 110 to 113. I won't, I'd just point them out to you because I just went over them on the spreadsheet.
Any questions of Mr. Turner? Any questions regarding the amendment? Senator Latz, are you moving that the adoption of the A9 amendment?
Yes.
Senator Latz is moving adoption of the A9 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. A9 amendment is adopted. Now we're going to move to the A10 amendment. And I'm assuming that Mr. Turner is going to articulate the meaning of this A10, or is there someone else?
Yeah. I hope he will.
Okay. Mr. Turner.
Mr. Chairman, members, the A10 amendment heading is interagency agreement. It requires the DOC to execute an interagency agreement with DHS to pay all Medicaid match costs, whether state or county, for MA-eligible inmates admitted to hospitals on an inpatient basis. The same language will be included in Senator Lurie's HHS budget bill.
Mr. Chairman, the only thing I will add here, you'll see that the state is picking up county costs. With the changes in the system, even though the federal government is picking up a lot of it, and that enables this whole savings to occur in our state budget, there would still be some residual costs for the counties. Because we have realized substantial savings at the state level, and because the counties have been in past years asked to pick up an awful lot of expenses that had in the past been state budget expenses, and because it would be very, very complicated because of the way the law works to get all 87 counties to agree to go through this process, and time-consuming to do that, we thought it appropriate to use some of the savings on this from the DOC to reimburse the county costs directly. So the counties should realize some budgetary relief as a result of this as well.
Committee, any questions to the A-10 amendment?
Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, not a question, but just a little bit of a supplementary information. In committee, we realized that there was an old bill that had been turned into law back in 1994 that committed the state to pay 50% of the community corrections bills for out-state counties. And during that, and as we discussed it, we realized that the counties had never availed themselves of that, and we were kind of curious of why they did that. We have to remember that Minnesota does not rely on prisons to incarcerate every prisoner. Decades now have decided that those that are not a violent or a physical threat to our citizens, it's better to put those individual inmates in a county correction system, mostly under parole or probation.
I don't know how.
And as a result, we have a disproportionate number, when you compare it to other states, we have a disproportionate number of people that are found guilty of crimes. We rely on the parole and probation system to take care of those that are not a physical threat. We don't put them into the high cost of prisons. But as a result of that, there's a higher disproportionate cost on parole and probation expenses. This old law that was written in 1994 might have been put into effect in 94, but it quickly dissolved away. And since there was flexibility to now reaffirm our commitment to the counties in this way, I think it was a wise decision to take the tact that Senator Latz is adopting in this.
Thank you, Senator Limmer. Senator Latz?
Mr. Chairman, I concur and appreciate the support for this. The A-10 amendment itself just facilitates the interagency agreement, so I'd ask we adopt that. But also, DOC would like to be heard on this topic as well, and they're here in the room ready to testify.
Thank you. Any other questions on the amendment? So you want us to move the...
I move the A-10 okay. amendment.
So the A-10 amendment has been moved for adoption. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. A-10 amendment is adopted. And I believe you said there's someone from DOC that wants to be heard?
That's correct.
Could we have him come at that time, at this time? And would you be so kind as to identify yourself for the record?
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. My name is Terry Carlson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Facilities Division for the Department of Corrections. The point that I want to make about this issue is that the assumptions that were developed for the fiscal note were developed primarily by the Department of Human Services, and we're very concerned about the reality of the savings for the agency for this change. And if this amount of money is taken from our budget and we don't realize the savings that are anticipated, that it's going to be an extreme hardship for our agency.
Any questions for Ms. Carlson? Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Carlson,
I think we do have a question. Senator Limmer.
How soon would your agency know you're going to have difficulty? Would it be in this next biennium, or would it be seen or manifest itself later?
Ms. Carlson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, I believe that the concern would start to be realized in fiscal 15, okay. where the most, you know, where it's at $5 million.
Senator Limmer?
No, I just need to know when to start focusing.
Mr. Turner.
Mr. Chairman, members. You're right. As we look, the first year, it's only a half year of implementation, but in fiscal year 15, the savings are projected to be $5,228,000. 16, it's $5,496,000. 17, it's $5,777,000. You're right to be concerned, but we did not come up with these numbers, so...
I understand.
Thank you, Mr. Turner. And I want to mention for the record that Ms. Carlson is the deputy commissioner, correct?
Correct.
Thank you. I just want to make sure I make that notation. Any other questions for the testifiers? Senator Newman. Senator Newman's A5 amendment is coming around.
And we're standing this is the one I handed out, I will say that given the A9 and the A10 amendment that we just adopted, my two amendments are now going to be changed a little bit, but I still want to bring them up. I'm going to offer them, and then I'm going to withdraw them, but I want to kind of generate the discussion. I will have to relook at the numbers again, given the adoption of A9 and A10, before I will decide whether I will bring these two amendments on the floor. But I'm going to, Senator Latz, I'm going to offer them, and then I will withdraw the amendments when we're done, and then we'll offer those before the night.
Sure. So the A5 amendment is being passed around. And I trust that all the members have the A5 amendment. Senator Newman, to your amendment.
We do not send per capita as many folks to prison as other states. So it's important to keep in mind that our local probation officers are really very, very important in terms of our overall corrections theme in the state of Minnesota. So what I have done with the A5 amendment is to take the essentially, and Mr. Turner will help me out here if I stumble, but essentially what we're doing is taking the increase in the funding for the state correction officers and spreading it equally amongst the county correction officers that serve both in the smaller outstate counties and the larger outstate counties. And what I'm trying to do is even out the increase in the funding to help the local probation officers in terms of their funding. And I'm going to ask Mr. Turner if he would just, you know, maybe go through the numbers for us on the A5 amendment. But in a nutshell, that's what I'm trying to do is just spread out the increase in funding for probation officers so that it's equal amongst the state and the local or county probation officers.
Mr. Chris Turner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Essentially, like Senator Newman said, what the bill does is it separates DOC community services supervisory staff, people who are probation officers from non-supervisory staff, because community services does a number of things besides direct supervision of offenders. And it creates its own line for DOC supervisory staff, and then it takes the savings and it takes the supervisory staff number and merges that with the $800,000 already in the bill for CPO and CCA, and then it reallocates them so that all three probation units, all three officers from the CPO, CPA, or CCA, and then the DOC state staff get a 2.7% increase. Technically, lines 1.4 to 1.8 is the new non-supervisory staff breakout within the bill. 1.9 to 1.13 is the new DOC supervision staff appropriation. 1.14 to 1.16 is the new CCA appropriation under the amendment. And then 1.17 to 1.20 is the new county probation officer reimbursement line.
Any questions of Mr. Turner? Senator Newman?
If there are no further questions of either Mr. Turner or myself regarding the A5 amendment, given the adoption of the A9 and the A10, I simply don't know what the overall effect is going to be.
I think we have a question. Senator?
It says in your letter that you've given requests from the probation officer in Meeker County that there was pending legislation in Senate File 932 that includes Pride County the 4% increase. Is that be reflected in your amendment? What's being advocated here by the probation officer in terms of collective bargaining?
Senator Newman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, I don't think so, but I think I'm going to rely on Mr. Turner to answer that question.
Mr. Turner.
Mr. Chairman, members, no, it doesn't. It doesn't reach the level of 4 and 4. What it does is it takes the rest of the DOC, institutions, operations support, and non-supervisory staff for the community services of the three divisions would still get their governor's pay increases. It'd be supervisory staff, state staff would have to merge their share with Community Corrections Act and County Probation Officer reimbursement, who are getting nothing in the governor's bill and only $800,000 in the division report, although now that's been jacked up with A9 to $4 million. But this would not do what your probation officer requested.
Senator Anderson, follow up. Any other questions around the A5 amendment?
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Chair?
I have a representative from the DOC that would like to add some additional information.
Thank you. Please provide your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ron Solheit. I'm Deputy Commissioner of Community Services at the Department of Corrections.
Proceed.
Thank you. The concern I have with the amendment as stated is it essentially results in a decrease or a cut to our field services staff, which is essentially our agents. We provide supervision, felony supervision, in 55 counties of the state. And essentially what this does is it would pull that funding from that portion of our agency's budget, and a cut in this size essentially results in us not being able to fund already approved salary increases under contracts, would result in a layoff potential of approximately 10 to 15 staff in our field services offices in 55 counties, which are primarily rural counties within the state of Minnesota.
Any questions for the testifier?
Mr. Chairman, I'll just add, Senator Newman's aspiration to more fully fund the county. probation officers, if we can find a way to do that, I'd be happy to work with Senator Newman to find the revenues somewhere to be able to accomplish that.
Senator Newman?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator Latz. And I appreciate the committee's indulgence in looking at this amendment. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I will withdraw the amendment at this time. Whether or not I bring it back on the floor, I guess I'll just have to relook at the numbers given the A5 and the A10. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Limmer has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe Mr. Turner could answer this. Back when the law was created in 94 to commit 50% of the funding to counties for community correction activity, how did they fund it then? Do you remember? We're struggling with that question now. How do we do it? We have the commitment in law, but we don't seem to have the means. How did they do it back then? Do you know?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Turner.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Limmer, I believe this goes back before 1994, which it goes back before my time. I think it was a good faith effort. They probably started at 50%. And on the county probation officer reimbursement, I don't think we've been at 50% in 10 years. Mm-hmm. I think we're at 31% right now. CCA, which is more complicated, it's the larger counties, the more complex systems. I think we're paying roughly a third of their costs right now. It's just very easy to let it. When you got to fund essential state services, it's very easy to tell the counties that we're not. It's easy to let them go, mm-hmm. And it's happened. If we had a graph in the last 10 years. It would be a downward slope.
Senator Limmer, any follow-up?
Well, I didn't realize this until just this year that there was even that type of a commitment that was written into our law. And if we struggle on a statewide budget, I can only imagine, due to the fact that we rely so heavily on community corrections, and if there was a previous attempt to help them with our state policies, meaning putting more people into probation and parole services rather than prison, we should find a way how to reinforce that effort that we're demanding from the counties. Now, I'm a Hennepin County guy, but I can understand the need in our more outstate communities that don't have all the resources, but we're dumping that on them. And we shouldn't be pinching money out of the corrections department on it. We should find a way to fully fund that commitment. I think it's needed. Otherwise, we could revert going back, unfortunately, back to a prison system, and that's not helpful either.
Thank you so very much, Senator Limmer. Senator Newman withdraws the A5 amendment.
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any other amendments before we proceed?
Mr. Chairman, I have a second amendment that I would like to offer and have distributed at this time. That would be the A7 amendment.
A7 amendment is being distributed.
Creates a shortfall of 43,000.
All right. Senator Newman, would you like to describe the A7 amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The A7 amendment has two parts to it, whereas the previous amendment just had the one part involving the local county probation officers. And this amendment involves funding for judges and for county probation officers. And again, given the fact that we've passed the A9 and the A10, I'm going to have to look at this again. So it would be my intention at this point to offer the A7 amendment. We'll have a discussion on it, and then I think I'm going to withdraw it and decide whether or not to bring it up on the Senate floor at a later date. But I did want to give Senator Latz an opportunity to look at this and consider it before going to the floor. The first part of the A7 amendment involves judges. And members, if you would go to the spreadsheet on this would be the first spreadsheet now, April 8th at 4:06 p.m., rather than the more recent one. You will see it on the first page. We've got the Supreme Court, Court of Appeals, and District Court. And for all three levels of the judges are scheduled under this proposal to receive a 4% salary increase in each of the 2 years of the biennium. I have had occasion to visit with judges, and they most certainly do want to have a pay increase. It was couched in terms to me that they wanted a pay increase for the most part to protect their staff, because their staff hasn't had a pay increase in a number of years. And I could be wrong, but I think their staff is getting 3%. Senator Latz, I'm sure, will correct me if I'm wrong. But in this case, we have got judges in this state who candidly work very hard, and they do a very good job, and their job is difficult. In the old days, we used to have a probate court judge, a municipal court judge, a county court judge, and we had district court judges. And now everything is all lumped into one, and the district court judges really have to have an expertise in a great deal of areas. And it is a very difficult job, and candidly, I think they do, for the most part, they work very hard, and they do a good job for us. But one of the things that I would ask you to keep in mind is I'm not so sure that they are grossly underpaid as things are right now. I think a district court judge makes $129,000 or thereabouts. I think I'm close. And this would then give them a 4% increase in each of the two next year, so a total of 8% increase. The state of Minnesota, I believe, also contributes to judges' pensions at the rate of 20%, which is a pretty significant employer contribution, or it may even be a little bit more than the 20%. So at least in my mind, judges are not necessarily grossly underpaid. One of the things that I do hear a lot in talking to judges is their workload. And they have pretty consistently conveyed a thought over the last few years that their workload is really very high. And keep in mind that the difficulty of their job, given an increased workload, really can bring about errors within our judicial system. So the first part of this amendment would take the 4% increase in the second year. The judges would get to keep the 4% in the first year. But in the second year, they would get that the 4% that they would get would be reallocated within the judicial branch, and there would be enough money to create five new what they call judge units. So it would be judges and their staff. And the idea would then be to let the judicial branch decide where they want these new judgeships to be established. And hopefully their workload and thereby our judicial system would be improved, because we have got more judges to do the job that is necessary. If we were to do that, it's my understanding there would be about a little over $200,000 left over. And the second part of the amendment then would reallocate that money from the judicial branch into the Department of Corrections and be utilized for our local county probation officers and spread equally amongst our county probation officers. So whereas the first amendment that we talked about that I offered has just the one part, This amendment has two parts to it, and I apologize to Senator Latz. I didn't intend to spring this on him. Before this morning's very, very brief conversation, We have not had a chance to talk about it. So again, it would be my intention to try and answer any questions that folks may have, and then I will be withdrawing it at the end of the presentation. And if possible, I could just have Mr. Turner comment on the financial aspect of the amendment to make sure that I got it right.
And to that point, Mr. Turner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. First part of the amendment, 1.3 to 1.7, all of those numbers simply reflect the savings from the second year on judicial salaries. For the Supreme Court, it's $55,000. Appeals Court, $138,000. District Court, $1,976,000, for a total savings of $2,169,000. Then you've got 1.9 and 1.10. It's $1,965,000 in the second year to fund the five new judgeships created in Section 16. These five judges are, the courts always have a list of if they were to get a new judgeship or five new judgeships, they have a ranking. And these five judges, these five districts, actually it's four districts, one gets two, the third gets two, came from the court. Then the 1.11 to 1.8, that's simply the DOC reallocating the DOC money. The remainder was $204,000. $180,000 would go to CCA, and $24,000 would go to county probation. And then, of course, the last part is the creation of the judgeships. That's the amendment.
Any questions to the A7 amendment?
Chair
Cohen.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Newman, just a couple quick questions. How did you determine which judicial districts you were going to add the positions to?
Senator Newman.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cohen, the allocation of the where the new judges would be chambered, as I understand it, comes from what is called a court needs report. In other words, the court keeps a sort of a running tally of what their needs are and, you know, where judges are to be chambered and how many they need. That's the source of this. So this comes from the judicial branch.
Senator Cohen?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Newman, just a quick comment, and don't intend to belabor your amendment. But normally where we've adopted new judgeships, there's usually been a request directly from the Supreme Court based upon the workload distribution. And I haven't seen that. So you and I both understand when we talk to members of the bench about an increasing workload with the increased population in Minnesota, some of the demographic changes, and so on. But usually over the years where we've adopted new judgeships, whether it be for the trial court or for the Court of Appeals, it's been through a direct request from the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court Administrator.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Cohen, I think you're right that normally what happens is we get a request from the Supreme Court for new judges, and usually what happens is we go for a number of years, and then ultimately the legislature comes up with the money necessary to create the new judgeships. I sincerely doubt that the Supreme Court would turn us down if we decided to fill their judgeships in accordance with their needs report. The reason why this is a little bit different is simply because when I look at the pay increase that is being recommended to the judges, I'm really not sure of any other group, either in private industry or in public service, that is receiving an 8% increase in salary over the course of a biennium, plus what I consider to be a pretty generous pension package at 20-plus percent paid in by the employer, i.e. the state of Minnesota. So the genesis of this is really to recognize that I think that there is a need for new judgeships out there, number one, and to bring to this committee's attention and to the Senate as a whole just exactly what it is that the judges are asking for, which I think is a pretty significant pay increase.
Senator Letts?
Mr. Chairman, members, first of all, I think the courts probably would reject the creation of new judgeships if it came at the cost of the entire pay increase in the second year of the biennium, and I'm going to ask Janet Marshall from the courts to come provide the court's perspective on this as well. It is not their request for new judgeships. It's their request for pay increases. Secondly, the Compensation Council, having done their thorough deliberation, prioritized this recommendation for judges' pay increases as well. For the committee's perspective, the judge's salary is right around the same amount as a first-year associate at Dorsey and Whitney. So, and it hasn't been increased since 2008. So I don't think it's fair to look at this as a 4% and 4%, 8% in the biennium. I think that's it misstates what's actually proposed. It's 3% salary increase in the first year. And then it's 1% to help with the pension fix, which, by the way, that plan has some substantial changes in both the state share and in the pension for new judges. It also catches up on 5 years of zero increases in salary. So if you really want to amortize the pay increase over the 5 years of no increases, okay, let's do that, and you'd have, what, 0.5% a year or 0.75% a year? Let's at least compare apples to apples. And you have, I would contend, most of the judges on the bench took substantial salary cuts from the private sector in order to serve. It also explains why there's a disproportionate amount of judges on the bench who came directly from public service, the public defender's office or the county attorney's offices, where for them it was probably a pay increase. But what you end up with is probably fewer judges on the bench with long-term private civil litigation experience when the cases that they're presiding over are heavily in that category. I think the judges, frankly, they're underpaid and their salary increases are long overdue. But I'd ask Janet Marshall to add the court's perspective, if I may.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Sorry, I have Jeff Shorba here, the state court administrator.
Mr. Chairman, if I may respond to one point from
Senator Newman.
From Senator Latz. I did not mean to intimate that the Supreme Court was in agreement with the creation of new judges or new judgeships if we paid for them out of the 4% increase in the second year. In point of fact, I would agree with Senator Latz. I don't think they would agree to it. What I did say was that if the legislature were to appropriate the money necessary for the creation of the new judgeships, I don't think they would turn us down. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. To testify, identify yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, my name is Jeff Shorba. I'm the state court administrator for the Minnesota Judicial Branch, and I'm just here to talk a little bit about our prioritization process for this budget request. Our judicial council, which consists of judges and administrators from around the state, put together our budget request to present to the governor and the legislature and considered a number of worthy items to put into that budget request, including asking for new judgeships. But given the limited amount of funding, we had to prioritize our request. And the judges on the council, the Minnesota District Judges Association as well, felt that this pay increase request for judges over the next biennium was a higher priority than asking for new judgeships. And we agree with the recommendation of the Compensation Council and the Minnesota District Judges Association, as I mentioned, which consists of members from all three levels of the courts, also agreed with that prioritization. So,
any questions for Mr. Schoberg before I go to Senator Limmer? Is this to the testifiers, Senator Wistrom?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Senator Wistrom.
Mr. Chair, to the testifier,
can you give me assurance with this pay increase, you're not going to move or take away a judicial position in the 8th District?
Testify, Judge.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrum, that is not my decision. That's a decision of the 7 members of the Supreme Court. Right now, they are looking at ways to share resources across districts to try to prevent that from happening in the 8th District. Mm-hmm. So we're having discussions with other districts that are underjudged about sharing resources, and we're talking about plans to do that. But I can't speak for the Supreme Court about their decision.
Senator Westrum.
Mr. Chair, and just to this issue, I figured I would get that answer, but I at least wanted it on the record. There's great concern that there would be a temptation or a need to move somebody, and I understand the pressures. The other pressure gets to be geography in this state, and we're talking Pope County, which has a retiring judge mandatory 70-year retirement coming up this month. In fact, I'm planning to go to the retirement reception in 2 weeks. My former mock trial coach, in fact. But the situation is Pope County serves Grant County, serves Wilkin County, serves Traverse County, serves Big Stone County, along with the two judges that are in Stevens County. That's a big geographical area. It also covers some of Candiwai County if there's necessity there. And so my point in saying that is I want to raise this issue. And I think Senator Newman, I'm just looking at it here, this might be kind of a balanced approach. We still have deficit issues. When there's pressure elsewhere for new judges and you don't fund new judges, the pressure becomes to take them away from a large rural area that might be a couple points below the judicial numbers they have, but you've got to take into effect, I mean, this is my district. I've got 8 counties in my Senate district, and you're talking an hour and a half of windshield time in some of these cases, and if you start moving them further away, it's going to be even longer. And so I'm happy to hear, I talked to one of our judges last week, they're working out arrangements where maybe 1 week a month every judge goes to the 7th District, the St. Cloud area, where there's some pressure to help cover some of those hours, and that's what I think you're referring to. But my point is maybe this is a balanced approach that we should look at, because the public is going to have a hard time saying 8% for somebody that's already in 6 digits. And Senator Latz, last I knew, and I think it's still the case, in fact, I know it's the case, I mean, when these openings come up, there are a lot of reasons a lot of people seek these positions, because they're still very well paid, they've got good retirement, they've got good vacation opportunities, and a good structure. And so there's other reasons than just getting the top salary that people are seeking these. And we have a judicial selection committee that has to wade through dozens of applications every time an opening comes up. And so it isn't that we're having to beg people to apply for these positions, and they're very qualified people that are applying. And so I think it might be something that we should look at as a balanced approach of recognizing there's still financial constraints, and when we don't fund new positions where there is undue pressure, it causes us to maybe talk about taking away from areas that currently need it as well.
Thank you, Senator Westrum. Senator Latz?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick response. Yeah, there are a lot of applicants for these positions. They're prestigious positions. But when staff all across the state are getting pay increases and have had more pay increases than the judges have, whether the judges are paid comparatively well or not, that doesn't mean they ought to be consigned to 0% pay increases for extended lengths of time, nor
would I submit it be fair to give them a smaller pay increase than other staff that also are public servants in the state of Minnesota?
Thank you.
I mean, they have fallen now from the mid-20s in ranking nationally to 34th nationally in terms of comparative pay with other states. We haven't historically. I know our judiciary is ranked near the top in terms of their performance, including in terms of the business climate, by the way they handle business cases. We've got a very high-performing, very efficient judicial system, and I think our judges ought to be compensated accordingly.
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize for doing this. I think Senator Westrom raises an important question, but Chair Newman, as I understood it, you were going to withdraw the amendment. So if it's not, if we're not actually going to debate and vote on it, I promised committee members we wouldn't be here all morning. So.
And I think we have one question, Mr. Chair, from Senator Limmer, if that's okay.
Well, Mr. Chair, in better to understand this a little bit, if I could ask Mr. Turner a question about the pension increase. The net pension increase is what? Is it like 2%? Is that what we're talking about?
The state share is
2%. Mr. Turner.
Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, the state share is 2%, and the judicial share is 1%.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair and members,
Senator Limmer.
I had a bill that I introduced late in the session, and I did it intentionally just to kick the subject around, but it might be good just to throw it out on the table. As you may know, there's a mandatory retirement of judges at the year 70 years of age. My bill is one to reassess the retirement age and reconfigure it at 72. By doing that with the income that those judges would make in that extended two-year period of time. Now, keep in mind, when the 70-year mark was created, I don't even remember when it was, somewhere back in the 60s or 70s. A 70-year-old is far different then than a 70-year-old is now with the improvement of health continuums for individuals. By adding that 2 years, I've been told roughly that of the 2% that we're talking of an increase in pension, that two extra years of service for a judge does have a benefit on the pension thing, that you could almost equal the same amount in a net fashion. It would reduce that 2% increase to 1.5. It's a 0.5%. 0.5% benefit if we just move the age of retirement to 72. That's all I'm suggesting, is something to think about as we wrestle with this sometime in the future.
Thank you, Senator Limmer. In the interest of time, I'm going to move expeditiously, so I'm going to ask Senator Bonoff to ask
brief,
a question. Thank
Mr.
you.
Chair. And not a question. I just did want to take the time to say that I had the occasion to meet with all the judges in my area over the break, and they shared with me their priorities. And I have spent time both with Judge Abrams in the Ridgedale Court as well as in Drug Court, and I'm pleased that we're doing what we can to support and be of service to our judges, as they are tremendously of service to all of us.
Senator Newman, to your to the A7, are you withdrawing that now?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members, for the discussion. Senator Latz, thank you for your consideration. And with that, I withdraw the amendment.
The A7 amendment withdrawn. Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, I was just going to make sure there's no confusion, because we have two spreadsheets. I would move adoption of the spreadsheet, which is timed 9:23 p.m., so there's no confusion as to which spreadsheet we're adopting.
The April 11, 9:23 p.m.
April 11th, 9:23
p.m. All those in favor of the adoption of that spreadsheet, signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed say nay.
No.
Spreadsheet is adopted. To Senator Letts.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to just briefly point out two notes in the content of the Senate file itself, 671, separate from the spreadsheet. One, just to call your attention to the fact On line 8.25, there is a filing fee increase for a certificate of compliance by the Commissioner of Human Rights for businesses who are seeking compliance certificates. The fee goes up from $75 to $150. It doubles, but then the length of the validity of that certificate of compliance is also doubled from 2 years to 4 years. So the net impact is zero on any particular business, but the businesses actually would find it preferable not to have to go in and make another application, and it would be more efficient use of resources by the agency as well. The other thing I wanted to call your attention to for your information is that on page 9.11 to 14, there is some language that is stricken from current statute, and I just wanted to call Senator Newman's attention to this as well, because I know he was involved in having this language added. I think it was 2 years ago now. Relating to the scope of services civil legal services can provide, there's some language that currently restricts them to only doing civil matters within the jurisdiction of state courts or agencies. For the decades before that, they've been able to serve their clients' needs, whatever those clients' needs happened to be, whether they were state or federal courts or agencies. So this strikes that restriction of where they can take their clients' cases so they can make the decision based entirely on the client's best interests. And I understand that the language may be somewhat unnecessary to strike it. I don't quite understand why, but this will clean up the statute in that regard, and I can have counsel explain that if necessary.
Mr. Backus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Ken Backus, Senate Counsel for the Judiciary Committee. Yes, it's technically not a statute that's being amended here. It's a rider from the budget bill 2 years ago. So generally speaking, riders are they can be permanent law, but they're often tied to the appropriation. So it's more of a temporary nature. But we consulted with a few people, and it was thought basically better safe than sorry. If the intent is to strike the language, let's just do it explicitly.
Thank you. Any other questions of the testifier or Senator Latz?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Turner would like to explain some language on.
Mr. Turner.
Mr. Chairman, members, there's two sections we haven't spoken about yet, Section 16 and 17. They provide that any funds received by DOC under contract with other states or the federal government for housing convicted felons or providing temporary detention shall be deposited in the state treasury and appropriated to the commissioner for correctional purposes. Just a quick historical note. The DOC used to house many federal inmates. They brought in a lot of money. They had a statutory appropriation about 10 years ago. We made it a direct appropriation. Since that time, the number of federal inmates has virtually dried up. That direct appropriation has remained within our purview. This year, MMB decided to strike the special revenue lines in the DOC appropriation because there wasn't any revenue there, and then revert to a statutory appropriation for the few times when they do have a federal inmate. And that's what 16 and 17 do.
Any questions of Mr. Turner regarding those provisions?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Latz.
Not seeing any questions, I'd like to move that Senate File 671 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor.
To that amendment, Senator Nienau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize if this was addressed earlier, but I was just looking at Section 22, the repealer, and I did come in a couple of minutes late, so I might have missed that. What's the purpose of removing that? It has to do with contracting for detention.
Senator Latz. Mr. Turner.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nienau. That's the inmate housing account in the special revenue fund that we set up 10 years ago. We said we're going to only directly appropriate it to you. Since we're making it a statutory appropriation now in statute, we no longer need that fund in the special revenue fund.
Thank you. If there are no other questions, Senator Latz, to Senator Latz's motion, that Senate File 671, as amended, be recommended to pass and move to the floor. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 All those opposed, say nay.
No.
What'd you say?
Motion.
Oh, thank you. The bill is passed, and it is moving forward.
And Mr. Chairman, then Monday we'll have, I believe, the higher education bill at 8:30.
Thank you. If nothing else, we are adjourned.